David Moore, who conducted the warm-up session for this case. And we have a number of special guests, and if they would stand and be recognized. State Representative Wayne Wood, who was here earlier too, thank you. It's good seeing you again. And the following Rock County, far left, is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to the far right, Justice David Prosser. And the podium will hide some of us, and for that we apologize. Pardon me? Oh, I am. Thank you. I'm so used to doing this by rote.
You've been working awfully hard lately. You can hardly see him these days.
I didn't even look to see who was here, and I know better. The empty chair is Justice Prosser's chair, and he usually sits there. But Justice Prosser will not be participating in the next case because, and Justice Prosser is authorizing me to say this, Justice Prosser was in the assembly, in fact, the Speaker of the Assembly, but he was in the assembly when the sexual predator law was adopted, and he took an active hand in its adoption and did file a brief with the court on the law, and on a case-by-case basis, he's deciding whether he will sit on any particular case. And I explain this to you all so you know why there's an empty seat, and also to explain to you that justices recuse themselves so that they not only are impartial, but that there is an appearance of impartiality because justices should learn things from the records of the case and come to the court and to each case in a neutral position and exercise their judicial independence in making decisions. So, with that said, I'm going to call the first case, which is 98-0152, In Re the Commitment of Wilbert L. Thomas. Brian Pollock, Assistant District Attorney of Racine, Wisconsin, will represent the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Pollock.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice, fellow justices. My name is Brian Pollack. I am an assistant district attorney in and for Racine County. We represent the petitioner, appellant to the state of Wisconsin in this matter. We are here before the court today to ask this court to find that Wisconsin Statute Section 980.02 entitles district attorneys throughout this state to file the so-called sex predator petitions simply if the Department of Justice does not do so. We believe this statute is plain and unambiguous on its face. In fact, both the parties agree that the statute is plain and unambiguous. However, we have come to different meanings for that statute. Our contention here is that DOJ, the Department of Justice, as well as local district attorneys, have dual authority here. The only difference between that authority is that there are different conditions precedent. The condition precedent for DOJ to file a petition requires a referral from the agency with jurisdiction, which most often is Department of Corrections. The only condition precedent for local DAs to file a sex predator petition is that DOJ has simply not done so. The respondent in this case claims that the petition in the instant case cannot stand because there has been no formal declination by DOJ, nor has there been a referral by DOC. We believe that the statute in this case is quite plain. It does not create this so-called gatekeeper function for DOJ, or more appropriately, for DOC.
Let me ask you, I see both sides are saying that we're reading this in plain meaning. So this causes a little bit of a problem. But I can just see, from a policy standpoint, isn't there going to be an argument if they don't file and you do, or vice versa? Did you see any policy concerns over what is taking place here as far as the intent of this statute?
I think the justice is right. There is a great policy argument which supports local district attorneys having the power and authority to file these. One only has to look at the statute to see not only does the district attorney from the county of the sex predator's conviction have authority, but the legislature in its wisdom has also entitled the district attorney into which the sex predator may be released after serving his prison sentence also has entitlement to file the petition. My belief of the policy is here is to make it a greater authority to file, to not allow individuals to fall through the cracks, so to speak, because the goal of the statute, the public policy goal, as this court has said, is protection of the public. That protection can be achieved by first identifying sex predators, by controlling them and treating sex predators, as this court has said. I don't think that we should consign this so-called gatekeeper function and limit it to only the Department of Corrections or the Department of Justice. If we were to achieve the public policy goal of this statute, which is the protection of the public, we should entitle local DAs who have firsthand knowledge of the case. They may have, in fact, prosecuted that individual. They're aware of, for example, perhaps other acts evidence, other individuals he may have sexually assaulted, which review of the records, which DOJ would do, they would not find. In addition, DAs, as the chief law enforcement officials of their respective counties, have the duty to protect their public. And if they're going to have a sex predator move into that county, who better than they to decide whether or not probable cause exists to issue such a sex predator petition? The real question is, should it be left to individuals in Madison, or should it be left to the local DAs from Eau Claire, Shoshone, throughout the state to make that decision?
Mr. Pollack, as you're well aware, there's a real difference here between the two districts of the Court of Appeals, District 2 and District 3. What do you view as the significant difference in approach of those two opinions?
From my point, Your Honor, I believe that our district, District 2, has relied too much on the statutory construction that the provision of Section 980.02, sub 1, sub B, in the language it states, quote, if the Department of Justice does not file a petition under paragraph A, their reading of that is that that paragraph A indicates that the district attorney is obligated to follow the recommendations of the Department of Corrections. They're reading the statutory construction, I think, to a point which makes the statute not achieve the policy goal for which it was designed, which is the protection of the public.
Now, why would the legislature require that the Department of Justice to have the, what's the exact language here, that the Department of Justice, at the request of the agency jurisdiction, let's just say that's the Department of Corrections for the moment, why would the legislature require that the Department of Justice needs the request of the agency jurisdiction and the district attorneys do not?
I think, once again, it has to go to the idea or concept that we like local control in this state. We have always put our trust in locally elected district attorneys, locally elected sheriffs. We do not have one supreme state police, and we don't have one central authority that handles all criminal matters. I think that traditionally the Department of Justice has represented, for example, Department of Corrections or Department of Health and Family Social Services, and the function they can act as a conduit from these agencies, such as DOC or DHFS.
Well, but then that's true, and they wanted local control, which I think has a lot of merit, but of course we don't make the public policy. Then I think they would have drafted the statute that says the DA can bring it of either one of these counties, and if the district attorney, the locals, people don't want to do it, then the department can do it when the state agency asks them. I mean, that would really do what you say the statute does, but it reads as if the Department of Justice and the Department the agency with jurisdiction. They're in charge. And then if they don't do it, then you have an opportunity if you get the request.
I'd beg to differ with the Your Honor's interpretation of the agency in charge. I don't think that we in this state want to make, for example, a Department of Corrections necessarily in charge. We want to keep that prosecutorial discretion where it belongs with the prosecutor and the local district
attorney. Counsel, I was just reading the language of the statute. The agency with jurisdiction has control over a person.
Yes. And I understand, Your Honor, that originally the statute was, in fact, written that way, which was modeled after the Washington statute that we based substantial portions of our statute on. And in Washington, my understanding is that is how the statute is today. The local district attorneys, in fact, do have equal authority, if not greater, than the Attorney General's office. And I know that our statute was written that way and it was changed. I think it was changed to, in fact, make the Attorney General's office, give them parity with the district attorney's office, not to actually take power authority away from the district attorney. As a matter of practical concern, the overwhelming number of sex predator petitions are in fact filed by local district attorney's office. In my county, for example, we've had 18 filings since the law took place, and we filed all but four of them.
Do you follow the language, and are you hanging your hat on one where it says a petition alleging that a person is a sexually violent person may be filed by one of the following? Is that key language that you just made the argument that gives the district attorney that power, you feel?
I think it's important language, but it's not the only language that we are hanging on for the statute. Our position is that if you look at the entire statute, it makes sense that the district attorneys have the equal authority. For example, local DAs as well as Department of Justice are each entitled to the same exact notice in this case. Why would that be a requirement if the district attorneys did not have the power and authority to file a petition? Why give the local DAs that notice? Why simply not rely on DOJ to tell the local DA what to do? This is so that local DAs are alerted. They can know when someone's going to be released to their community or someone they may have prosecuted and sent to prison 15 years ago. They're well aware of alerted and can file a sex predator petition if DOJ does not file for any reason. We have to once again remember that DOJ could not choose to file for any number of reasons, including financial, logistics, manpower considerations. And so the statute does not require this formal declination. We don't need something that's certified by DOJ that says we're not going to issue, simply the fact that they don't.
So often in policy, there is a mirror effect. The strength is the weakness. You make the argument that the policy of this state in this type of case and these kinds of proceedings is give it to the local authorities. Who knows better? Yet I think of 944.21, which deals with obscene materials or performances, and it provides that a district attorney cannot initiate a case without first on obscene materials or performance, without first submitting it for review to the AG. No civil or criminal proceeding may be commenced unless there is approval for the prosecution by the Attorney General's office. That seems inconsistent with what you say is the general policy.
Actually, Your Honor, I think the court, of course, is correct on that assertion. There are, in fact, two other provisions in our statutes which create and give the Attorney General the so-called gatekeeper function. The one the court just mentioned. The other is wiretaps under Wisconsin Statute Section 968.28. The Attorney General must approve this, as well as under 165.017, emergency detentions under Chapter 51. My argument to this court is that if, in fact, it was the legislature's intention to create such a gatekeeper function, it certainly had the knowledge, the wherewithal, and the precedent to do that. And it has explicitly done that on at least three prior occasions that I could find and chose not to in this case. It could have easily written this statute saying that local DAs do not have the authority until the Attorney General agrees and consents to the filing of those petitions. They chose not to do so.
It would seem to me, and I was just thinking of the argument, we're talking about policy, certainly Justice Bradley's question, I think, alludes to that. What about the idea that the Department of Corrections would be the gatekeeper, as we discussed here, because of the to insulate any political pressures. You know, being from Racine, you have, I think, the question of just there would be more pressure to do something.
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, as of course Justice is aware, we don't have anybody appointed in for any positions in life. We're all subject to political pressures, whether it's a local district attorney, a local elected judge, the governor. The attorney general is elected. The governor who is elected appoints the head of the various departments. I don't think that's a valid argument. The purpose of a democracy is to make elected officials responsible to the electorate. The local district attorneys have a duty and obligation as a chief law enforcement official to keep the trust of the people. If they do not, they can be voted out of office. I look to that argument as the opposite, as ensuring that the local elected officials comply and do their duty and their obligation.
What about the legislative history here?
Well, as this court is well aware, our argument is, in fact, that the legislative history is not necessary to look to because the statute is plain on its face. However, this court is entitled to look to context, subject matter, scope, history, and the objects intended to be accomplished to reinforce and demonstrate that a statute plain on its face, when viewed historically, is unambiguous. This court, in Parker v. Sullivan, said amongst the items which this court can use for statutory interpretation is the needs of the public and common sense. The needs of the public in this case are protection from sex predators. Common sense tells us that in order to ensure the best protection, that we need to have district attorneys involved in this and not a single gatekeeper. The legislative history, as indicated, has been modeled after the state of Washington. There were a number of changes. Originally, the district attorneys had complete authority, and attorney general's office could not file unless they were requested by the district attorney's office. That has been mentioned. From our viewpoint, the change in the law entitled or brought up the attorney general's office to a parity level with the district attorney's office. It has been mentioned here, gatekeeper. I like to use the analogy that there are dual flanks. There are two equal forces available to the state of Wisconsin to ensure that protection of the public, the attorney general's office as well as the local DAs.
It doesn't sound to me like they're equal. It sounds to me like the Department of Justice, on the one hand, is subordinate because it can't act unless it gets a request. So that seems to be subordinate because you're taking the position you can act without a request.
We are. And in that sense, I think that goes back to the argument of the local power for district attorneys, once again, that I think the electorate and our legislatures have a history, a tradition in this state of approving.
But my point is that, on the one hand, the Department of Justice is subordinate because it has to may have a request. On the other hand, it seems to be higher in ranking here than the DA because you can't act until after the Department of Justice denies it. So if the Department of Justice says it's going to go ahead, it has control over that, and you might think better arguments could be made or better psychiatrists or psychologists could be brought in. You're out of the picture, if I understand this.
And I would agree with the court's interpretation on the very latter point. I beg to differ. I believe that, and once again, that is the duality. There's always checks and balances, such as we have the three separate branches of government.
But you're not checked. We only check on you, and I say you, I don't mean you personally, but on the district attorney, is that the Department of Justice has decided not to act. Otherwise, you're unchecked.
Well, I don't believe it's that way, Your Honor, because we have the same checks and balances which are available to district attorneys in any criminal case we prosecute. For example, the SCR code requires that we be interested in justice, not just the conviction. We're responsible to that. We can't file a petition until we have a psychologist or psychiatrist who says that the person's a sex predator. We then have to file a petition. A judge has to decide whether probable cause exists. And then we have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very high burden. So we certainly have checks and balances as well as our obligations.
Sure. But ordinarily, one of your cases where you prosecuted a defendant, the district attorney does not represent the state at the appellate level.
That's correct.
Department of Justice represents you.
In a felony proceeding, that's correct.
Felony proceeding. And the Department of Justice might decide they don't want, they would prefer not to represent you because they think that the issue is one that you're going to lose on, or that you should lose on, and the law is the other way, etc. That doesn't happen very frequently, but it can happen, right?
Correct.
So in that sense, you are at the mercy, for lack of a better word at the moment, of the Department of Justice.
That could be an interpretation. We can certainly ask to represent ourselves, much as we have done in the instant case.
Right, and which you've done in other cases that come to our court.
That is correct.
Okay.
I certainly agree that there are, once again, the checks and balances, and some of them may be for practical considerations. I would suggest to this court that there's very practical reasons to allow the Department of Justice to be the conduit from the DOC or DHFS, whatever the agency is. That is, we would expect DOJ, for simple manpower reasons, to perhaps be able to develop an expertise in these cases. For some of the smaller counties, they may not have the manpower to devote the time necessary to develop that litigation expertise because of all the various complexities of this law. However, we have also created two special ADA positions. There's one in Brown County, and there's one in Milwaukee County, where these people are assistant district attorneys, but have in fact specialized in handling sex predator cases. Even in my office, which is amongst the largest in the state, we have 18 lawyers. I don't think any of us will claim to be a complete expert on sex predator cases because we have to do other matters. And so that is a practical reason to allow the Department of Justice to act as a conduit from DOC or DHFS.
Counsel, how do you respond to this policy argument? And it's a policy argument that insulates the district attorney from undue local pressure. If a forgery felony were committed in a county, I don't think there would be a swarming of the population to come to your office to knock down your door and say, we want you to prosecute this forgery. If someone committed, I mean, there may be a few, but I'm talking about en masse. If someone committed a robbery or a burglary, you're not going to have half the population of the community maybe even knowing about it, let alone caring about it. But if you put a sexual predator in someone's neighborhood, everyone knows about it, and everyone has an opinion about it. And isn't there a policy argument to be made, to which I want you to respond, of in order to insulate the district attorney, who's an elected official, from local pressure, that this is then put in the Department of Justice, who also has a check from the Department of Corrections? How do you respond to that, I think, very real policy argument?
My response, Your Honor, is that local district attorney's offices are always brought under political pressure, whether it's a sex predator case, or they can be, I'll rephrase that, horrible murder case, horrible child sexual assault kidnapping case, those same kind of pressures can be brought. Even the forgery case, if it's written to a very prominent individual in the community who's very powerful politically or financially, those pressures can also be brought. The district attorney has to respond as his duty and obligation and trust to the people, his obligation based on the evidence, and his obligation based upon responding to any particular crime as you would any light crime, not based necessarily upon the victim. So those are things that local district attorneys, I beg to differ, have to go through all the time.
You think there's nothing unique about sex predator? I mean, I may be wrong, but I just sense that if you said to someone, two blocks down the street, you're going to have someone who was previously convicted of robbery, they may not like it. Or two blocks down the street, someone convicted of embezzlement, they might not like it and talk about it at their card parties. Two blocks down the street, they have a sexual predator, and their kids walk that black in order to go to school, I think they're going to have a little stronger opinion.
I agree that is their special concern, but once again, the district attorney does have the checks and balances, which I alluded to in the normal process.
And the checks and balances is one of strength and integrity of each district attorney?
Strength, integrity, and the ability to prove the case. The case still must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge still must find probable cause. A certified psychologist or psychiatrist must be able to say that this person meets the three requirements. of the sex predator petition. So those protections are there. I don't think that there is that insulation, because if there is enough stir, political stir, the news can get to the governor can talk to the Department of Corrections. I mean, we know that these things can happen. We are not insulated in this state from political pressures. Even this august body must face election at certain times. So we all can be, at least have the appearance of these political pressures. I don't think that's a public policy reason to take this policy of protecting the local constituency out of the hands of the district attorney. If we can charge a first-degree murder case where someone can be incarcerated for life, why is it that we don't have the wherewithal to prosecute on our own volition a sex predator case, which the Department of Justice has chosen for whatever reason not to issue?
Just a practical question. You hired the psychiatrist, Dr. Palmero, on your own. Was that was ex parte? You didn't have to go before a judge and get an order?
We did receive an order from Judge Vuvenis, the trial court judge, allowing access to the files for Mr. Thomas.
Okay, thank you. The legislature requires that before the Attorney General acts, Department of Corrections must request it. Why would the legislature require that the Department of Corrections act as a gatekeeper with respect to the Department of Justice, but not with respect to District Attorney?
I suggest it's because it's the history and tradition of DOJ representing other state agencies such as DOC or DHFS and being their representative in court. There are many different proceedings that do represent DOC. The District Attorney's Office does not historically and traditionally have that same relationship of representing local arms of the state government, representing arms of the state government.
Your position is that the legislature didn't want the Department of Justice to move forward unless the Department of Corrections said okay, because the Justice Department represents the Department of Corrections.
I believe that may be a way of summarizing it, yes.
Mr. Pollack, you had mentioned that there were a couple of positions created, assistant district attorney positions created. One you mentioned was Brown County. Can you tell me whether or not, first of all, people filling those positions cover more than one county? And if they do, how does the case get assigned? How does this process work?
My understanding is the Brown County assistant who handled this position covers basically a lot of northern Wisconsin. For example, we'll go over to Oneida County or Shawnee County, and that will come through the normal procedure, which DOJ will make the decline normally, and then it'll be assigned to the local DA, whether that's Shawnee County, Oneida County, and then that local DA will ask for the expertise of the prosecutor out of Brown County to come and handle this case, because that is his bailiwick and he does have the experience, and quite frankly, for the local DA, that allows him to use more time for other cases. So in a sense, that is an answer to the issue of the local political pressure. These local DAs are willing to give this case up to basically an out-of-towner to come in and handle that case, at least in those circumstances. Thank you.
So your red light's on. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court, and Chief Justice and Justices, I'm Jack Shire, Assistant State Public Defender, and I represent the respondent in this case, Wilbur Thomas. This court can look to the legislative history of this law either to corroborate the fact that the statute facially provides for a referral to the Department of Justice in 980.02, and then if the Department of Justice does not act under paragraph A, to the district attorney of either the county of commitment or the county to which there will be release, or they can say that this court can say that two reasonable bodies of learned people, District 2 and District 3 of the Court of Appeals, have come up with diametrically opposed conclusions with regard to the same issue, and that in fact it is ambiguous, and look to the legislative history on that basis. The legislative history itself is such that in the 1994 special session of the legislature in May, Governor Thompson requested the bill which created Chapter 980, which was Assembly Bill 3. And that was introduced by the Joint Finance Committee. And as originally proposed, that legislation provided plenary authority for district attorneys to file Chapter 980 petitions. The Attorney General could only file at the request of the agency with jurisdiction, and in this case, that would be DOC, or at the request of the district attorney. And if, in fact, the Attorney General handled the case at the request of the district attorney, the county would pay both for the evaluation costs and also the commitment costs. Now, in Assembly Amendment 2, which came in through the Joint Finance Committee, this process was stood on its head. Instead of that rationale, there was a referral required from the Department of the agency with jurisdiction, and if the Department of Justice did not file within 30 days of discharge or release, then the district attorney of the county where the person was convicted or the county to which release was to be accomplished could file. Now, subsequent to that, the Governor Thompson vetoed the 30-day restriction. So we have a situation where, unlike the parity claim that has been made by the Racine County District Attorney here today, we had a situation where what he essentially is asking for is a type of policy that was changed by the legislature, and in fact the authority of the Attorney General, the flexibility to file, because of the 30-day restriction, even that was knocked out by veto.
Now,
in terms of this...
I'm sorry, Counsel, you submitted some documents on November 9th.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, referring to those?
Yes.
Okay. Where does that all show up? I've got your the governor's veto message, I guess.
There is a description of item 40 in that, and it shows that the 30-day restriction is being released to give more flexibility on it.
All right.
And there is a description from the Fiscal Bureau of the effect of Assembly Amendment 2 and the other documents.
Can you read that to mean that, the department has to, or the agency with jurisdiction has to request the DA?
No. What I refer that as meaning is that the same gatekeeper function applies that was put in by Assembly Amendment 2, but the Attorney General is given more flexibility rather than less by what was done through the political process. Again, this reminding the court that this was a bill requested by the governor.
Okay.
Now,
what I'm reading, just referring to that May 19, 1994 letter, the middle of the...
This is the one from Bob Lang.
This is the one from Bob Lang, the one that you just, we received on the 10th, basically.
Yes,
it says in the middle of the paragraph on first page, Amendment 2, just provide that if DOJ determines it will not prosecute the petition, either the DA of the county of conviction or the DA of the county of release may prosecute the petition at their own cost. Now, it seems, I'm just reading that, and this is not a document I've had a lot of time to study, that seems to say that if you don't, I'm talking about if the Department of Justice does not take the petition, then the district attorney would have the ability to prosecute that at their own cost. That's why I asked the question of your opposing counsel about what happened here. He said, well, this is an ex-party. We went and hired this psychiatrist, and we got an order from the judge to give us the records. But I'm assuming that the prosecution would be at the cost of the county of Racine.
Your Honor, the only...
If I read that wrong, or...
What the document provides is, and I'm going back to the Fiscal Bureau statement of what Assembly Amendment 2 provided, was that essentially the state would pay for the cost of both. It says at the bottom of the page of the first of the memo, the last sentence, the cost of evaluation, care, and treatment of a person committed under the bill would be funded by the state, regardless of who prosecutes the petition. So that, I think they went to a state-funded operation, Your Honor, as I understand.
Mr. Chair, I note that 980.015,
yes, sir,
which is the notice requirement, requires the Department of Jurisdiction to notify 3 months prior to release both Justice and the DA.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, if, and it's your position, that before the DA can do so, can file, the DOC must have filed a request with the Department of Justice. That's the gatekeeper,
yes.
Why would the statutes, why would the legislature require notice to the district attorney if that is the case, if there's a first step?
Your Honor, my belief is that what this, the district attorney has a function if the the attorney general does not decline. And they need to have information as well as the attorney general. And they may need to be in a position to act expeditiously if there has been time used. So my sense is that this is a way to provide all parties with necessary information should the need arise to use it. We also must realize that in this type of system, Mr. Pollack, for instance, in his argument, has referred to the number of prosecutions in Racine and the number that were initiated by the district attorney. This is a cooperative arrangement of shared responsibility between two law enforcement agencies with the same purpose. And so it seems to me that what happens is that, as a practical matter, this notice is helpful and it is useful in just as the process functions.
Except, counsel, under your interpretation, the Department of Corrections holds all the cards. Right?
Your Honor, under what I'm saying is that the legislature established the gatekeeper function. And I think there are a number of policy reasons for that. And in fact, it took away what was originally proposed to permit the district attorneys to file. Now, there's a, if you, I can address some of those policy considerations.
Sure. What are the policy reasons for letting the Department of Corrections decide, and assuming there are valid policy reasons for doing that, then why require Department of Corrections or the agency who has custody to give notice to everybody if they're going to be the ultimate decision maker or gatekeeper?
Your Honor, I think the reason for the Department of Corrections to file, excuse me, the Department of Corrections to evaluate these cases is they certainly have an expertise. They've dealt with a person for a very long time. They see people from Racine, Superior, and all aspects of the state. Okay? And in terms of the situation, they can evaluate without being affected directly by the political process people from all areas of the state. And they also see people in terms of a continuum. This is not a person who was just convicted yesterday, and we know that he, as a predicate, had everyone had a sexual violent offense, but it may be 8 years down the road or something. They have had all kinds of experiences, both with treatment and other things, which bear on it. The department has an expertise, and this is certainly an area of specialization with development of risk factors, actuarial models, and things along that road that would indicate that the department is in the best position to make an evaluation. In fact, in terms of this particular situation, the reason I believe that that notice is given, even though there may not be a referral, is that a referral can potentially be made along the road. In other words, you have to file within 90 days of discharge or release. But I don't think it's necessary that a referral come at the 90th day or before. There may be a time factor there, and this is to ensure that all parties with responsibility have information. should the need arise.
But what good is that information if the Department of Corrections, as I said before, holds all the decision-making cards? If the Department of Corrections does its evaluation, and it may be in a superior position than anybody to conduct these evaluations as a first order of business, let's concede that, but assuming that to be the case, they still, under your construction of the statute, are the ultimate decision maker, because if they decide this guy doesn't qualify as a sex predator, they don't make the referral to DOJ, and the local DA is devoid of any options under your interpretation. So what's the point of all these notice requirements to the local authorities if the local authorities don't have the right to overrule the Department of Corrections and say, we disagree, we want our own expert to look at this guy and see if he qualifies or not?
I think that the notice, again, I think I may be repeating myself, but we know that in terms of the gatekeeper function, the department has to make a recommendation and make a referral. And at that point, the attorney general then can decline. If, in fact, there is no referral, the fact that there is notice will simply be make no difference. However, if there's a change of circumstances, if ultimately there is a referral, all parties who may be involved in the prosecution will have information.
Right, but if the notice makes no difference, then we've got a construction on a statutory scheme that renders certain significant portions of it a nullity, which is contrary to the rules of statutory construction, is it not?
Well, yes, but I think you have to look at these things in paramateria in one entire process. But I think that the legislative history is outlined in terms of what happened through the Joint Finance Committee. Made clear that the legislature rejected a system whereby the district attorney had plenary authority to file.
Well, we don't even get to legislative history, though, if the statute construed in its totality is plain and unambiguous on its face and we can give effect to its language, correct?
I think the court, Your Honor, my understanding of the rules of statutory construction are if, in fact, a statute is capable of being construed in two different ways by a reasonable person, resort to legislative history can be undertaken.
So it's your position that this is ambiguous?
If it cannot be viewed supporting facially the requirement of, in other words, it can corroborate under the Martin case, the view that it is unambiguous as to permit the gatekeeping function, but if it is disputed and it's ambiguous, if there's differing interpretations, it's ambiguous. And I would say that there's a strong argument that it is ambiguous in this case because two different courts of appeal have come to two different conclusions.
And the trial court here disagreed with the court of appeal, didn't it?
That's correct.
So you got four judges disagreeing.
And I think,
sorry, John. So you've got, obviously, disagreement among, six Court of Appeals judges and a couple of trial judges. But is there no purpose for the notice otherwise? Is there a purpose to give notification so that the DA can at least begin to explore it should the Department of Justice decline? Is there a time limit on the DA to bring the proceeding? I would think there is, because there's a limited time during which you can start this before the person's released.
Under sub 2AG, there's 90 days to file before the person's released. And in this particular situation, the district attorney can file up to the day of discharge, the attorney general can file up to the day of discharge or release. And therefore, there is a time factor. And this is one of those things, because it may not be known until the very last minute what's going to be happening, and certainly all parties who have potential involvement in this situation need that kind of notice.
Think about this.
You're not.
Now, what about, suppose neither the department nor the district attorney is going to file this petition and the person is released? Are there any notifications then?
There can be, if a person is released to the community, there can be notifications. My understanding, there are notifications to the law enforcement officials. Also, then, there are provisions in probation and parole for careful monitoring of high-risk offenders. And there could be very stringent conditions such as monitoring and things along that line.
They're putting a lot of weight on this cross-reference in this statute, this reference to whether the Department of Justice declines in accordance with paragraph A. Isn't that what you're leaning on?
We are leaning on that, Your Honor, because I think the state's position would, in effect, read that section out of the statutes. I think it's one unified situation where we, as we've argued, that there is a gatekeeper function. I would like to address a couple of things, if I could, in response to the questions from the court. First of all, Racine District Attorney's Office has argued that the policy is, in terms of these cases, is simply to protect the public. Now, in the Keith case in the Court of Appeals, they mentioned that, but they also said it's to treat high-risk offenders. And this court has said, in the Post case, which upheld the statute, that, in fact, the law is narrowly tailored to confining the most dangerous of persons. And in Carpenter, which was a companion case to Post, this court also said that the statute has a purpose of treatment and is not to warehouse people, and that essentially upheld its constitutionality because it was not punitive. And in the United States Supreme Court, in the 5-4 decision in Kansas versus Hendricks, the concurrence of Justice Kennedy focused on that retribution is for the criminal system, and in the civil system, if it's punitive, it could have rendered this unconstitutional, or certainly in its application. I think there's an important problem here with the argument of the state as advocated by the Racine County District Attorney. First of all, you have a system, he claims that there would be parity between the district attorney and the attorney general. In fact, the district attorney could file without restriction, and the attorney general could only file if there was a referral. Secondly, this court has held open in the Kynetz case whether, in fact, an expert is needed in these cases. And I think it's conceivable that a district attorney could take the position that no expert is needed. They could simply have people from the community or whatever lay opinion and file, and there would be no check whatsoever. And the process that has been undertaken here, also there's a problem just in terms of mechanics. I think it's been conceded by Mr. Pollack, as I understand his argument correctly, that there is a process of referral and working together here between the Attorney General's office and the DA's office as it exists. Referral or not, and at a time when a referral may be in process and not even known, and simply overtake the process. In other words, it may, in fact, render the Attorney General's function meaningless.
Counsel, let me just ask you, because you discussed briefly the Carpenter and Post cases. Now, I think just in Carpenter and Post, I think that this court made clear that this was truly a remedial and protective. It was not a punitive statute. And this is a policy argument that you were making, but it would seem that the purpose of protecting the public and providing treatment for sexually violent people would be best served by allowing the district attorney to, quote, file a petition when the Department of Justice does not. And that's what happened. I'm talking about what happened in this case. The Department of Justice did not file that petition because the clinical psychologist said, well, first I thought I should file it, and then there wasn't time, and I conferred with my colleagues, and then I decided against filing. But wouldn't the purpose of the statute, policy-wise, be would favor the district attorney filing in this case?
Your Honor, I think my analysis would be that the function, as identified in Post, is a narrow construction to confine the most violent of people.
Yes.
I think there are going to be differences of opinion between psychologists perhaps in many of these cases, as to whether a person is amenable or not. We're talking about protecting the public at the same time balancing the having a non-punitive system. And it seems to me that in this particular case, there are controls through parole and other aspects. You can have very stringent monitoring that would deal with this if, in fact, there is a basis to file. What I think, though, is that the district attorney here is making policy arguments to this court, which should be appropriately made to the legislature. The legislature had it before it in the May 1994 session, exactly what he is asking for here, as I understand it. In other words, plenary authority without referral to file these cases. And the legislature rejected that, and they provided this gatekeeper system. And if he believes that there are reasons that the legislature should amend this or change this, I think that is the forum for which he should appear. Mr. Shire, let me...
Justice Bradley.
Counsel, earlier I raised the statute of 944.21 dealing with obscene material of performance. And the response of your opposing counsel was, look, the legislature can and has written statutes that say before you can go forward, you have to ask Captain, may I, you know. And they didn't do that in this case, that the legislature in 944.21 stated that the DA has to submit the case for review to the Attorney General office, and the Attorney General's office shall determine whether a prosecution may be commenced by the DA. So if they want that, they can say it. They have said it.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the what happened here in terms of the initial draft of the legislation, which is referred to in the LRB note in Assembly Bill 3, and what happened in the amendment, turned it on its head. In other words, it took a DA system for filing and changed it completely. Now, if the language is not artful, the language is not precisely what is in Section 944, I think its effect is what has been prescribed. It's interesting because what's happened is, well, Mr. Pollack has said in a practical effect, the Attorney General serves this function. The cases come through the office, and they go to the district attorney. It's been 5 years since this law was implemented, and now we're getting this case to this court. And I think what's happened is that the gatekeeper function is something that appears to have been working in effect for this period of time. And I believe that if, in fact, in a particular case, again, I'm stating that in order to give effect to the statute, to give effect to the meaning of paragraph A, that you have to read this in terms of the gatekeeper function, and certainly the history shows that it was not designed, absolutely not designed, to provide unlimited ability to file without referral by the district attorney. Thank you.
Mr. Shire,
yes, sir.
Let me ask you, let's look for a minute at the Shaw case, which was the case decided by District 3.
Yes, sir.
They seem to put a lot of emphasis on the language, one of the following, which is found in 980.02 paren 1. And then, of course, after that, A, we have the Department of Justice, and B, we have the district attorney. You seem to be ignoring that language. Are you doing so, or why don't you think that language is as significant as District 3 thought it was?
Your Honor, I think that I respectfully disagree with District 3's analysis. I think that District 2's analysis, that it was correct in terms of saying that it ought to interpret it as was requested by the state would essentially read as requested in paragraph A out of the statute. And I think the key is going to the legislative history, and in that circumstance, Your Honor, I think it makes it absolutely clear that the legislature did not provide for plenary authority for district attorneys to file in these circumstances.
Well, didn't District 2 basically ignore that language as well? Having read the Thomas opinion from District 2, it seems to me that they're ignoring that language and paying no heed to that language.
I think that they're, my analysis, Your Honor, is in terms of their rationale, they considered the entire statute and felt what was dispositive was the language about reading out the language in paragraph A.
I have a question. Let's suppose that the Department of Corrections, and we've been using that, doesn't ask the Department of Justice to go ahead.
Okay.
Then your so the Department of Justice cannot go ahead, is that right?
That's correct.
All right. And the position, if I understand it, of the Racine Assistant District Attorney is they can go ahead. The Racine DA can go ahead.
That's my understanding.
Now, let us suppose that the Department of Corrections says, let's go ahead, DOJ, and the Department of Justice says no. Well, you think the Department of Corrections that says go ahead means to say only go ahead if it's the Department of Justice, but doesn't intend to go ahead if it's the district attorney?
I think that if I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, what happens is if the Department of Justice declines or there's a declination, either of the appropriate district attorneys can file. And I think, obviously, this happens frequently, as at least the experience that we're seeing shows.
If they got Department of Corrections approval.
If there's a referral.
A request.
And
in this case, there was no request.
There was no referral, as I understand it. In other words, there was initially a review, and then there was a memorandum to Steve Pinker at Justice that they were not going to be recommending in this case. Thank you.
Mr. Pollack, you've got a few moments for rebuttal.
Thank you. So Mr. Shire has indicated this law requires a cooperative arrangement between equals, not subordinates, in order for it to function. In order for this law to work, DOJ and local DAs really have to work hand in hand. We have communications back and forth on a continuum. The way the process works as a practical matter is that individuals, when they come up for parole, are reviewed, and there is a practice where so many are eliminated along this continuum. Eventually, a special purpose examination can be had where a licensed psychologist makes that determination whether or not the person does, in fact, qualify. The law is designed not for DOJ and DA's offices to compete with each other to see who can get the most headlines or who can get the most cases. The purpose is to protect the public.
Well, and in that regard, counsel, doesn't the respondent's interpretation subordinate both the DOJ and the district attorneys of the county of conviction or the county of release to the bureaucracy?
It does, and then that's in fact why we reject that. There have been some what-ifs put forth here, and I guess I could throw some more into the mix why our interpretation, I think, is the prudent one. What would happen if a governor down the line were elected who completely disagreed with this law and appointed the Secretary of Department of Corrections, who didn't want to have anything to do with this law, and he ordered all his subordinates not to make any more referrals for sex predators? If we were to accept counsel's interpretation, there would be no sex predator law, and that would completely defeat the purpose of the legislation.
You always have the opportunity to go back to the legislature.
Of course.
Regardless of what this court says, or your view, or the public defender's view, you can go back and clean it up.
Absolutely, if that's necessary. But, of course, our position has been in this case that the statute is unambiguous. In that regard, much has been made by the defense to the language under 9802 sub 1 sub B. If the Department of Justice does not file a petition under paragraph A, they have basically hung their hat on that provision. It is our contention that that provision, that phrase, only refers back to, in fact, paragraph A. We must remember that there are two other types of petitions that can be filed under Chapter 980. They are supervised release petitions and discharge petition. That sentence is not surplusage, or that fragment of a sentence, if it refers back to sub A and, in fact, refers to a petition for determination of sex predator status, not for these other types of petitions, which are also available under Chapter 980.
But counsel, they wouldn't have put this in under 980.02 relating to other petitions. I mean, there's nothing else in here, is there, that relates to other kinds of petitions?
Not in 980.02.
Right. So now, they could have said, if the department doesn't file a petition, DA can do one of those. Now, when you say if the Department of Justice does not file a petition under paragraph A, I think in very strict legislative reading, it would read, if the Department of Justice does not file a petition at the request of the agency with jurisdiction, because that's refers right back. It puts in the language of paragraph A. The DA for one of the following may file. I mean, what when you have a cross reference like that, you ought to be able to substitute the words. Because that's just a shorthand.
I'm not sure.
I know that's not acceptable to you, but tell me how you read that in legislative interpretation, if you don't read it the way I just said.
I read it to the fact that the Department of Justice is referred back to paragraph A, and they cannot file a petition for sex predator status unless they have been referred by the agency. I read that as not requiring that the district attorney have such a precondition or condition precedent to their filing of a petition.
So your position is the Department of Corrections knows this person may have been imprisoned 5, 10, 20 years, whatever. They don't think that this person should be prosecuted or held under Chapter 980, and they don't request it, but you think the district attorney can go ahead and do it. And that's what the goal here is.
That is, in fact, the goal. I submit to the court that any bureaucracy is only as good as its individuals, and that we should not, when the goal is protection of the public and control and treatment of sex predators, we should not necessarily be bound by a single individual's determination in regard to a particular instance. As in this instant case, although it's not part of the record, in fact, Mr. Yannakopoulos has now changed his opinion and found Mr. Thomas to be, in fact, a sex predator. So those kinds of things can happen, and I don't think we should be limited.
Is that part of the record?
No, it is not.
That's not part of the record, okay.
Do you realize that your argument is to be contained in the record?
Yes.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That would end our hearing on...